The Solitary Traveller.
The St. Ives Show.
Welcome to The St. Ives Show. Each September, the small seaside town of St. Ives in Cornwall holds a two-week festival of music and the arts, in which local artists, musicians and poets are showcased in events held all over the town. Supplemented by concerts every night from national and international stars in the town's Guildhall and Western Hotel. This year featured the likes of Show of Hands, Gordon Giltrap, Eliza Carthy, Elkie Brooks and the Ukulele Orchestra of Great Britain. St. Ives on the northern coast of the Tip of Cornwall, once a very important fishing town, is now a curious mix of family holiday venue and a haven for artists. Some of Britain's most famous artists have lived and worked here over the years, and as a result, the town boasts a Tate Gallery all of its own. It opened in 1993. An important part of the festival is the daily open event held in the afternoons at Norway Square, a public area which is surrounded by three of St. Ives' landmark establishments: the Society of Artists, the School of Painting, and Bob Devereux's Salthouse Gallery. In this show, we talk to some of the artists and musicians who organised and performed in the square, and we hear some of the reasons why St. Ives has become so popular with so many creative people. We'll start with Rod Bullimore, who is a comedian, musician and one of the coordinators of the Norway Square Sessions. We spoke to Rod in his flat, which overlooks one of St. Ives' famous beaches. So this is the St. Ives Show. I'm speaking to a local performer and writer, Rod Bullimore. You do quite a bit of music, don't you?
I do music, yeah. I started off doing poetry, and then I lapsed into comedy, and I started playing the guitar, and now I do a bit of music, but I wouldn't call myself a musician. I'm a songwriter, and perhaps a singer-songwriter, who happens to play the guitar, a bit like perhaps Leonard Cohen. I'm essentially a poet, but I just transfer my lyrics to music.
So it's really just amalgamating poetry and comedy ideas into the music, really, and having fun with it.
Yeah, I've got comedy songs, and I mean, poems normally you have to adjust them a little bit to make them fit. Make them actually fit the music a little bit, so it's not pure poetry, but my music's more about the words with a few chords thrown in, whereas some people do a lot of music with a few words thrown in, but I'm essentially poetry-based, yes.
So what are some of the songs that you've written?
Oh, I've written about 40 songs. I've written comedy songs. I do political songs. I've Struck the Messiah, which is about Tony Blair. I've done some soft love songs. One about drugs called Keep Off the Grass. I've got quite an eclectic mind. I do political. I also do romantic. And I do comedy. Comedy, yeah. I've got a catalogue of about 40. Which I perform round and about, but it's not my main thing. My main thing is writing. Yeah.
So really, but you have fun. You have fun with the lyrics, and you can sometimes make a statement with them.
I think most of the stuff I do has got a statement somewhere. I don't believe in writing a song for the sake of writing a song. I mean, normally it might be something political. It might have something to say. I've just got this out of the paper today about the girl who took some poison and ordered the doctors to let her die. And I did have a song, incidentally, which is about Dungeon Gill, which is about suicide, basically. It's about a man committing suicide on Dungeon Gill, which is a lovely place in the Lake District. So I do write about things that matter. Yeah.
So really, there is a great amount of variety of material that you'll write about, all kinds of subjects, really.
Yeah, that's probably my problem, that I don't focus on one thing. I do music, I do comedy, I do poetry. I'm trying to write a book as well at the same time, so my time is quite...
Really, in the tradition of St. Ives, a very creative, all-round endeavours that you do.
Yeah. One day I might wake up and I might feel like doing some poetry, another day I might wake up and say it's quite hard to concentrate on one thing when you're doing so many things, which is not necessarily a good thing, I think, but I can't help it.
So how long have you been doing these creative things?
I came to St. Ives 15 years ago, and I'd written a little bit before then, but when I came to St. Ives, I realised that this was a place I could write, because there were so many creative people around, and nearly everybody I met was doing writing, and it encouraged me So I've been doing it on a serious basis for about 15 years, I would think, now, yes.
Because there's a creative energy, and a lot of people often feel like they want to contribute to it.
Oh, it's a fantastic buzzing centre, because, as I say, all my friends... OK, we're moving a certain circle now, but all my friends are musicians, poets, writers. So you're constantly pushing each other along, I think. And there's a whole creative buzz about the place anyway, yes.
So do you find you collaborate with other people?
I have collaborated with other people. I've done comedy theatre. I did a thing called Culture Break for 5 seasons. We were 15 comedy shows and sketches. But like all good things, it came to an end. People moved away. But I have collaborated with other people, but I'm not that good at collaborating, really. I'm not a very good collaborator, I think. I like to do everything my way.
Because otherwise you have to compromise and be democratic about what you do, and it's quite difficult to do that.
Yeah, I don't like compromising. I mean, if I could pay them loads of money and say, right, do it my way, and that would be it. But if I've got to compromise for the sake of getting someone to collaborate, then I don't necessarily want to do it, which it's not a good thing. It's my nature, I think, to do it my way. Yeah.
So what was it you think made you come down to St. Ives? What drew you here, rather?
I wasn't drawn here. I came down by accident, almost. I finished university. My grant had run out. I went as a mature student. I lied about the mature bit, obviously. But my grant ran out, and I came to see my son in Newquay. He was surfing in Newquay, and I ran out of money. And it was a case of either earning some money or hitchhiking all the way back to Grimsby. So I went strawberry picking round Hale. And then I saw there's a place in St. Ives to rent, and I'd been in St. Ives when I was a child, so I came to rent a place in St. Ives, and the strawberry picking season finished, and someone said I could make money daffodil picking. So I thought, unemployed in Grimsby or unemployed in Cornwall, I'll stay in Cornwall.
No contest.
And once I found St. Ives and found all these writers and musicians and poets, and it was difficult to go back. Yeah. So I never returned. I came down the close I stood up in and basically stayed.
So, did you do creative things before you came to St. Ives?
I wrote a little bit, but not particularly. It's encouragement from Bob Devereux in the Salt House Gallery. I've written some poetry before I came to St. Ives, but never any music or comedy or anything like that. I'd written a cartoon strip many, many years ago. I always had writing in me, but I used to be in the police force, and there wasn't much time for poetry in the police force. So.
Yes, you can't be creative there, you've got to stick to the law.
Well, yeah. Well, being a poet and being a police officer doesn't quite tie in. So once I got down here, and I just finished university. I did a BA honours, literature based, because I was interested in writing. So obviously I was interested in writing before I came here, yeah. Mm. And then I got a degree and went daffodil picking with it, yeah.
So you could say the St. Ives made it really easy to be creative and really gave a lot of inspiration.
Oh, definitely, and there's always work here. I did lots of work. I worked in shops, daffodil picking, strawberry picking, just to get by and stay here, so purely because it's a beautiful place, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, I'm going to agree with that. Now, St. Ives was actually the basis for something you did. You used the town in a comedy show with sketches, and it was called Snotton TV. So,
I've been doing Culture Break for... 4 or 5 years of the comedy theatre, and we finished Culture Break, and one day I was sitting outside the Sloop and some friends asked me what I wanted to do next, and I said I'd like to make a film, a satirical film or comedy film about St. Ives, and they offered to put up the money for the camera, so basically I had to do it. Mm. And it was all based on people I know in St. Ives and the whole ethos of St. Ives, the art, and it's satire, but it's a comedy film, and it's called Snotton TV. It's the first time we've ever made a film. Mm-hmm. We sold about 700 copies in St. Ives, yeah, so it went down very well, but it was also very hard work.
It's a lot of editing. Now, who helped with the editing, was it?
Unfortunately enough, in St. Ives, you always know friends who... Alban Reynard was a cameraman, had a camera, was a friend of mine, and he edited it all down and produced it. Acted as a producer, as I say. The fortunate thing about St. Ives is... he was on my doorstep and he was there when the conversation started, so it just all came about with a casual conversation.
Yeah, but quite
a few too many beers.
So a lot of it was observations of things going on, sometimes conversations in the pub that you overhear.
Conversations in the pub, the art, the Tate Gallery, and different type of people you meet. It's light-hearted, it takes the fun out of everybody, including poets.
I mean, do you use that sort of thing in your comedy songs and your poetry as well, where you well, observe things? And
I'm quite an observer, and I think you pick these things up, and they go in subconsciously, and then when you're writing, it comes out, yeah. So it's a lot of social observation, sitting in pubs reading books, and it sinks into your brain and comes out again later on, yes.
Yes. What we're going to do now is going to play a Castrated Love Song, which is one of the songs that you've written. So tell us a little bit about that song.
Oh, that was the first song I wrote, actually, which if you listen to it, you'll tell, because it's only two very simple chords. And I wrote it about 3 years ago. I was just sat in my bedroom playing with the chords. And, I had a friend. I had a female friend who was a bit of manic depressive, and she used to lock herself in a room and play Morrissey songs. And I tried to write her a love song, but I couldn't, so I wrote a castrated love song, and I nicked the chorus off Morrissey, which is What Difference Does It Make?
Yes.
But so when you hear it, you'll hear the chorus, which I did steal off Morrissey, but the rest of it is all my own work, and it's a castrated love song. I didn't have the balls to go through with it, so I made it funny.
Yeah. So anything can be adapted.
Yeah, oh yeah, I think so. And it's still the one I get asked to play quite a lot because of the humour.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Thanks very much, Rod Bullimore.
I look out the window, it's 2 a.m. There's a hole in my roof, lets the rain pour in. I know when you left me, you said I was boring. My psychologist says it's just low self-esteem. But what difference does it make? Now you're a Ferrari, I'm just a Trabant. You are a joy, I'm a miserable person. Tried to be happy, I really hated it. This was a love song till I castrated it. That's why I'm sad and alone. But what difference does it make? Now I am the oldest emo in town. If you are happy, I'll soon drag you down. Gonna be famous, it didn't last long. Some bastard called Morrissey nicked all my songs. Now I'm all sad and alone. But what difference does it make? Now I am the oldest emo in town. I can make Morrissey look like a clown. If you were a horse, I'd be holding the bridle. My songs can make teenage girls suicidal. Psychology says I have low self-esteem, but I'm too dumb to know what he means. But what difference does it make? Now I am the misery, and you are the fun. I'm the bird on the wire, and you got the gun. You are the baby, let me be your nappy. I can make Leonard Cohen sound happy. You are a party and I am the waking it. I can make Morrissey look like he's faking it. That's why I'm sad and alone. But what difference does it make?
Next on the St. Ives Show is Bob Devereux. He first came over to St. Ives over 30 years ago, and he's currently the proprietor of the Salt House Gallery. Bob is a poet, a musician, an artist, and he's been a prime mover in St. Ives September Festival and the daily events in Norway Square. A mine of information, and he's full of first-hand memories of the many characters that have passed through St. Ives. Bob Devereux is himself a well-known figure about the town, and he had plenty to say when we met up with him inside his Salt House Gallery.
Hello, this is the St. Ives Show, and I'm with a local artist called Bob Devereux. Would that be right in saying that you're a local artist to St. Ives?
Well, yeah, that's fair enough. Yes, I am. Yeah, I've been here a long time. I actually moved down to Cornwall in 1965 and started getting actively involved in St. Ives in 1969. So, yeah. I suppose I'm local by now.
It's sort of like being a local celebrity, similar to Rod Bullimore. Everyone probably knows who you are.
Yeah, oh, they do. Mm, definitely, yeah.
And do you get that feeling when you walk through the streets that you're kind of known and, you know?
Well, yeah, I don't... you know, even if you were just working here, after a few weeks even, you'll begin to be recognised on the street. It's a small enough place, and although the population isn't all Cornish now, there's a habit in Cornwall of greeting you by saying, "All right, Ari." And I tend to walk through my day saying, "All right, all right, all right," and occasionally getting an answer like, "Oh no, I'm not feeling great," or "Oh, the wife died yesterday." But most of the time, it's just a greeting, and it's a wonderful part of feeling that you belong.
Because a lot of small places have customs which you start to realise belong only to those small places.
Yes.
I mean, it's so tightly knit as well.
Yes, you know, it is.
Both in the density of the buildings and also the diversity of the town, in terms of if you walk just a couple of streets, you're at one beach with another part of town with a completely different focus to another.
Yeah, it's its own little finger of land sticking out into the sea, and so you can cross it as if you crossed an island and find yourself in another place and with another view. Yeah, it's a magic place. I love it dearly. And I come here every day if I'm not otherwise engaged. I've got a gallery in the town. Well, you know about this. You've discovered it, called The Salt House, which I've run since 1979. And before that, I had a stall in the craft market from 73. And before that, I was the deck chairman on the harbour beach from 71, and before that I was running a festival in 1970 and then working as a waiter at the Harbour restaurant, which burned down in the June of 1970.
So really it's been quite a long history. You've seen many eras in St. Ives.
I've watched it change, yes.
So in what ways would you say that it's changed then, or some of the changes?
Well, in those early days, when I first moved into the town and got active here, so 69-70, the population, it was more heavily chapel-driven, it was more Cornish. There was a welcoming element, but there was also suspicion. And through the 60s, the beatniks had found that it was a place to come, and they were only partially welcome. So in the bars, it said that they wouldn't serve people with long hair. And in 1969, a girl in Island Square decided to open a boutique where she painted the word revolution in big mauve letters onto the first floor of the building, and advertised that she would paint flowers on the navels and of visitors. And the ladies of Island Road were up in arms. They said she should be tarred and feathered and flung in the harbour, and they said it on national radio. So it's changed enormously from that. But even at that stage, it was primarily incomers that were running the holiday-orientated businesses. It changed again, really, because it was very much like that through the 70s. But then in the early 80s, some of the younger members of Cornish families became entrepreneurial and opened restaurants and pasty shops. And they have become the strength in the way the town works now. And Simon's family own 4 restaurants and a pasty-making business, and they're still the local plumbers. They're still the local plumbers as well. So, you know, people like that. have made another change in the community. Becoming a part of the holiday trade means that the Cornish in St Ives have grown to accept it and all its complications. The art colony goes back a long way, right back to 1885. That was when artists first settled here, before the holidaymaker, and only shortly after the train arrived. And they were tolerated, but they had to toe the line. For instance, they couldn't go out and paint on a Sunday. That was disapproved of. They tried to invite the Cornish into what they were doing. They had show days before their work went off to be exhibited in London or at the Paris Salon or anywhere else. And of course the subject matter was very much the fishing community and the landscape and seascape. And so that was easily understood. But they were only tolerated, and there were problems between them because they came and loved what they found. They didn't like the smell, but they loved the buildings. They loved the local characters, and they wanted to preserve it as it was, whereas the Cornish that lived there and lived there forever wanted to change it and better themselves. So there was a friction between the artists trying to preserve their subject and the Cornish trying to improve their way of life. Lots of other things too going on. There was a lot of trading. It was a cosmopolitan place. It wasn't simply that the artists were a cosmopolitan lot. It was also the place was a trading centre because they were selling pilchards to countries in the Mediterranean. They were exporting them in barrels, and they were bringing stuff back. So they were bringing back spices and tea and coffee. So there were delicatessens in St Ives quite early, and after Fortnum and Mason's in London, the biggest importer of spices was Leyte on the harbour, a good Cornishman.
So it just happens to be a collaboration, it's a strategic location really for many reasons.
Yeah.
One for the light really, and the ocean location for artists. The fishing because of where it is.
Yeah.
And also
well,
that.
Yeah, that's right, it is. But, I mean, the business of strategic location for fishing, obviously, there were three fleets here. There was herring, pilchard and mackerel. And the pilchard industry died. The fact that it died meant that there were locations for artists to move into, to set up studio spaces where barrel coopers had been, where sail lofts had been, where stabling had been for horses. All of this had become vacant.
It's like,
but yeah,
it's like the Porthmere Studios on the edge of the. On the edge of the coast there,
yeah.
And now we're being inhabited by fishermen and also by artists in the same building.
Exactly,
because kind of relationship goes
yes,
on.
It was. And as these things emptied, so there were still fishermen there, so you'd have fishermen operating downstairs and upstairs, you'd have studios. But the other reason why the artists moved down, it was the subject, but it wasn't the light in the way that we perceive it now. The light wasn't quite the same because it was still industrial down here. There were tin mines, there were copper smelts, there were iron founders, and every house had its chimneys too and was burning coal. So the atmosphere was not as clear and the light was different. The Newliners, when they moved in, referred to the grey light of Newlin. And the first people coming over the Tamar into Cornwall in a train talked about travelling into hell. So it wasn't as it is now. And the reasons that they came were because it was well south. which meant that the hours of daylight were longer, and which meant that it was more practical to paint in a studio if you had a north light. You were nearer to the equator. And well west, which meant that it was milder, so that that meant it was more possible to paint out of doors. Major reasons for being in this location in Great Britain. And it was happening exactly the same on the continent. Anywhere this side of the equator, within a country that was well south and well west, was likely to be where the artist settled.
So next we got an example of Bob Devereux's work when he does a performance of his poem about Tony O'Malley, an Irish artist who lived in St. Ives. Bob is performing this outside in Norway Square as part of the festival where people get to perform each day anything they wish in the square.
And this is a series of poems that come together as one poem that come out of conversations with him. Sea, air, crow, feather, field, stone, bone, stir in ashes and seeds, and stand on a sill in a good north light for a year. The potion needs history. Apply to the eyes, open them wide, and you may find the man who made the marks. O'Malley has blue eyes that spark and twinkle, lilting and lyrical. His voice dances through County Kilkenny, conjuring the shades of his youth. Derry down Derry, merry with memory of buskers and tinkers and unfrocked clergymen, the 40-pounder and old claw hammer and Daniel Feeney's elbow. And oh, how the stories grow, more musical by the minute, till he stops and fixes me with his wise bird's eye and says, "But I've not the gift of words like you. I have trouble in writing a letter." Oh, the Irishness of the man. But never mind, his brush will paint himself out of the hole he's talked himself into. It's as difficult for a poet to define a poem as it would be for a terrier to define a rat. But he'd know one if he saw it, said Tony O'Malley. But where the quote came from, he couldn't remember. Just then, the sun came surging in through his window, merging the whole view outside of sand and sea and sky in one glorious Turner-esque understatement that sent words scurrying into dark corners for fear of being too defined. So he sat there, silent for a while, with only a smile hovering between us. But now, do you see what I've done? I've made Turner the originator, and the sun is the imitator. Words are terrible things if you let them run away with you. Pink, pink. Pink, pink, pink. Very soft. Feather touch. Like birds' feet on sand. Then wash of grey coming in. Layer on layer. Layer on layer. Could be sea mist. Could be anything. Pink, pink. Pink. Pink, pink, never mind what it is. Never mind what it may become.
Another resident of St. Ives, but with a more technology-based output, is Paul Healy. Paul has a sound and video studio in his home, from where he produces films with music and sounds that have been processed and changed far from their original form. Two of Paul's short films featured in the Late Night Frog, which is a kind of Cornish open mic session, held in the St. Ives Artists Social Club, which is a very venerable building which is on the town's seafront. That's played host to performances from a very prodigious list of talent, many of whom you can hear on this programme. It's the St. Ives Show, and with me I've got another local artist called Paul Healy, is that right?
Paul Healy is my name, yes. I am a multimedia artist living and working in St. Ives. I make short films from my home studio. I also write poetry and produce my own music for the films. I'm a bit of a hermitage, really. I spend most of my days up in my garret producing these films, and then come down from the hills now and again to engage socially with my peers.
So have you been taking part in the September Festival?
I have, for the second week, yes. I appeared at the Frog, where I accompanied Bob on the flute and showed a couple of my films. Before that, Bob and I were away on a cruise around the Baltic, visiting several places of interest, mostly the art galleries and the bars.
So, it's common for a lot of artists here to have their own studios within the town. Do you have your own set up somewhere within St. Ives?
I have a studio in my house, yes, in the attic, with a nice view of the bay, and I spend far too long there.
So you could have a view of the bay, but you may not, you know, you may be too engrossed in work to actually look at it half the
time. Yes, it's just a mere distraction for me, the view of the bay.
What sort of things are you capable of making in the studio?
I transform sound into, I can take electronic pulses and give them rhythm, all sorts of things, voices, foreign languages, for instance. I'm very interested in chopping them up and rearranging them and making my own world.
So, I mean, you've said that you put music to poetry.
Yeah.
So, do you find you make quite a lot of tracks in the studio that you intertwine with the poetry? Or
yeah, I have the poetry first, and then I apply the music, make several tracks, and I can add effects to various tracks, and then through the medium of film I can portray this work. That's basically how I perform.
So is it an all-round picture where you use sound, you use words and music, but you also use video as well?
That's right, yes.
So you can really just about edit anything in there?
Yeah. And it's all my own work that I use. I don't, you know, so it's quite long-winded. In producing a couple of minutes video can take me 4 or 5 months.
So a couple of videos were shown at the St. Ives Frog last week.
Yeah.
So what were they about?
Well, one was a friend of mine, David Holmes. This is a painting that he'd done, and for some reason I got him to walk around the town holding it over his head. I know that David likes Spanish music, so I created a Spanish feeling soundtrack for that particular film. Now whether what people read into that film is entirely up to them. That's how I like to leave the canvas blank.
So it's quite an abstract thing, really.
Yes,
it's just
yes.
just a case of moving pictures, and you put your own meaning onto them.
That's right, yes.
Okay, well, thanks very much.
It's a pleasure. Pleasure doing business with you, sir.
Martin Barker is a regular visitor to the town, and he's become a mainstay of the musical side of the Norway Square Sessions, often accompanying other artists, as well as singing and playing his own tunes. He doesn't live in St. Ives, but he comes up to the town 4 times a year. I caught up with him inside the Salt House Gallery.
Well, this is the St. Ives show. We're here in the top room of the Salt House Gallery with a musician, Martin Barker.
Hi. Yes.
Yes. So you've been up for the St. Ives September Festival.
I have, yeah. Come every year. Well, I've been coming for the last 13 years. And first of all, I used to come as a spectator. I just accidentally fell upon the square, this is Norway Square, while we're here. And then I bumped into some lovely people and some great musicians, and I sort of joined in with it all now.
Yeah, so you regularly associate with such St. Ives top people as Bob Devra and Rod Bullimore.
Bob Devra. Who's this Rod Bullimore? Is he quite a famous chap? I think he is quite famous in town.
Yeah.
Especially in the Sloop.
Yeah, I'm getting the feeling, yeah, that down, especially in the downtown type of area of Sloop, that he is pretty famous. Now, but what would you be famous for?
In St. Ives? I suppose for playing in the square, really, in Norway Square, and playing the guitar and singing, and playing with other musicians.
So do you write your own songs?
Yeah, I do, yeah. I've wrote an album of songs, just released it, called the Martin Barker Band, with a few musicians. You haven't got a copy of this, then?
Oh, well, actually, yeah, I have, actually.
Yeah, you haven't played it yet? Have you?
We could play one of the songs later on.
Yeah, yeah. But that's good that you've got a copy of that, then, yeah.
So you,
and I've even got a toothbrush and travelling lights.
One of the only essentials you probably need.
That's it, yeah.
So I noticed that you gave away free copies of the album to anybody that went to the Wednesday show that you did as part of the September Festival week.
Yeah. I had this printed. It was made in Ireland, the printing of the CD. I've got a company to do that for me, and I recorded it at my home. I have a studio at home, and I had a professional sound engineer come and do the twiddle of knobs for me, so I could concentrate more on playing the instruments.
Well, all the mastering and the EQ and reverb and all the tricks that you do with tracks that you got someone in for. And
yes, that's it, yeah, yeah. I do record some things on my own, just, and I'm looking after the controls and things, but I find it's more relaxing if I get somebody in. And I'm fortunate to have a friend called John Spence, who's a professional sound engineer, and he's worked with people like the Blues Band.
So where are you actually based then? Where is the name?
In the deepest depths of Goole, which is East Yorkshire, not far from York and Hull and Doncaster and the glorious Scunthorpe.
So,
where, funnily enough, that where Rod Bullimore comes from, he comes from a place called Kidby, which is near Scunthorpe.
But he became drawn to St. Ives later on.
He came down here daffodil picking, living in a Thames. I didn't know him then. I didn't know him before I met him in the Sloop, and then we ended up being great friends. And he writes poetry and does comedy acts, and he plays guitar now and writes his own songs, which are very, very good.
That's right, one of them being the castrated love song.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
So you find yourself drawn to St. Ives as well, because you're part of this crowd, and do you come down every year for this festival?
I do, I come every September, and I come about four times a year, actually, now, to St. Ives.
Yeah.
So it's not always festival time now when I come back.
It really does have that pull on people, especially creative people, because it really seems to be where it's at for those sorts of things.
It is, yeah. It's a fantastic place. And you meet these different people who you've met years before, and they come from all over England and from other countries. And then when you see them in a square, it's lovely just to see them there.
So I'm just wondering, really, is that, you know, with St. Ives being the way it is it perhaps unique in the world? Because there doesn't seem to be many places equivalent to St. Ives, and just having that amount of creative activity within one square mile.
That's right, yeah, it does seem that way. And there is music going on all the year round in St. Ives. There's a lot of musicians and artists, of course, poets. And it's happening all the year, but when it's festival time, it's a little bit extra special. People seem to come down here from all over the place. But St. Ives itself is just a lovely place, and it's hard to describe. You need to come. And once you've come here, you know the answer to it. It's no good asking someone about St. Ives.
Really, just one of those things that you have to come and experience to understand it.
That's it, yeah. You can tell them it's lovely blue seas and lovely blue skies. Not always, it's rained sometimes. And it seems to be like full of fresh air and open space. But you need to come and experience it, really. And then once you've been, I think most people are hooked on the town.
So what are your plans then to do next? Have you got any plans for what you want to do with music? And
yes, I've got a band back home, and we mainly play acoustic these days, but we do some electric gigs with electric guitars, and we'll be doing a small tour when I get back. We're starting in November, but mainly in the north of England. Not big gigs, just sort of small art centres and pubs. And yeah, that's the sort of thing I'll be doing.
What sort of music is it? How would you describe it if you had to say, oh, this is what I do?
Well, I suppose I do a lot of blues, but rhythm and blues. But this guy came up to me the other day and said, you gave me a CD, and I thought, why is he giving me a CD of blues music? I don't like blues. And then he said, then I put the CD on, listened to it, and I thought, no, it ain't all blues. I mean, I will play some sort of folky things and pop, I suppose, really. I like most sorts of music. I suppose it's sort of rhythm and blues-ish. Yeah. I'm just doing a tiny bit of a song for you, if you want, Mr.
Yeah.
This is not a blues song, but it's the first track of the album, it goes.
And so on.
Yeah, that's it.
That's an interesting idea.
It's called Mr. Slowman, actually.
Finally, tonight on the St. Ives Show, we caught up with the author Kelvin Bowers in the bar of the famous Sloop Inn. It's an ancient pub at the edge of the harbour, whose walls are covered in paintings and where fishermen and artists have met for a drink or two alongside the local fishermen. Kelvin has written two books. One, a true story of his epic run all the way from England to Australia in the 1970s. And his most recent is a children's story about one young lad's dreams of becoming an Olympic athlete. I spoke with him just outside the inn.
Well, this is the St. Ives Show, and I'm talking here with Kelvin Bowers. Now, you've travelled a very long way from St. Ives, haven't you?
It was a long way, and it was a long time ago. In 1974, I ran from Stoke, where I lived, where I come from, all the way to Australia.
So you're actually saying that you practically ran across the world?
Well, halfway.
Right.
but it was at a time when you could, certainly you could make that overland journey. A lot of the hippies used to go from England to Nepal. And there used to be things called the magic buzz. So I went. I mean, once you're across the channel, you can actually go on foot. I went all the way on foot. I crossed the Bosphorus Bridge, linking Europe with Asia, and then all the way to southern India. So I was able to go all the way to southern India before catching a ship from Madras to Fremantle in Western Australia.
Wow.
And then I ran across the Nullarbor Desert in Australia and finished in Sydney. Yeah.
So you actually ran through the continents of Europe, uh-huh. Going through Eastern Europe, and what countries did you go through to get down to the Indian Ocean?
Turkey, Iran, Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and then the whole of India.
So there's a few reasons why it might not be so easy to do that today, especially going through Afghanistan.
Yeah, I think the year after, I think it was 74, we did it, it was late 74, in fact I can remember leaving Kabul on December the 13th, and it was 1974, and then I think the following year was when the Russians invaded, and so very, very soon afterwards it became difficult for ordinary travellers to move freely through Afghanistan, certainly. And now it's, I mean, and it's never got any better since, and that's all those years ago, and it's still wild and getting wilder by the day country to move through.
So what sort of an experience did you have running through places at times? Did you find that there was ever any obstacles, things you had to avoid? Or
women would scream at our legs if we showed too much, you know, bare flesh. We had to sometimes put tracksuit trousers on, and they'd throw stones at us too. And some of them in Eastern Turkey, we were stoned a few times, and the Eastern Turkey, we'd pass nomads in Afghanistan, and some of them would sort of chase after us, but not in too threatening a way. They carried guns, yes. But they didn't. They weren't out to fire the guns. They were just throwing stones and things that we could sort of handle if we ran fast enough.
So it was a sort of warning run almost.
Yeah.
This is what we can do.
That's right. Yes, yeah.
But of course you were well accustomed to running yourself, so.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Have you actually were an athlete?
I mean, that's the difference, because in those days there was no such thing as jogging, fun runs, and joggers. You were either an athlete or you weren't, you know, and you were in a running club or not. And I mean, it was long, long before the first London Marathon, for instance. And we did meet, strangely enough, in Iran. We stayed with this man, a US commander, and he told us all about the new thing that was sweeping the States called fun running. And we, at that time, we'd never heard that term used. And he got the people who were attached to the embassy in Iran doing fun runs around the Shah's palace, around the outer perimeter of the Shah, the grounds. And that was, way back in 74, 75. That
was. It was probably popularised when they had the character in Forrest Gump run across America. It's part of that story.
That's right. Well, I don't know when that happened. That happened quite a bit afterwards.
In the
90s. Know when that was. Yeah, yeah. Well, so you probably remember more than I do.
So you'd been to Australia before.
Yeah. So, and that was where I got the idea from. Yeah.
So when you went to Australia, you said that... that you nearly could have gone to Vietnam if you had arrived at a different time, because...
Well, what it was is I went as a £10 assisted passage. You could pay £10 in those days and go out there, and it was handy if you had a job. They did like you to have a job, and I got a job as a tram conductor in Melbourne before I actually arrived. And then... But my main aim was to train with this athletics coach, and what I didn't realise at the time was when, after you'd been living in Australia for a certain length of time, you were required to register for national service, and the Australians, they were engaged in warfare in Vietnam, so a lot of my friends were draft dodgers at the time, youngsters, and all of a sudden, as well as running, I became involved in the protest movement, the anti-war movement too, that went on.
Well, could have easily had an involuntary trip to Vietnam.
That's
circumstances
right.
Have been slightly different.
That's right. I don't know. I think I'd have try to get back to England much sooner than the 2 years. So, supposed to, yeah, you're supposed to stay there for 2 years if you've, you know, gone on this assisted passage.
It's amazing that you could go for just £10, but you did have to have a job. But they haven't. But they didn't have the same ability. They couldn't come to the European Union or the UK for just £10. So yeah, how did they view that?
My Aussie mates didn't, you know, they didn't like the idea that, and they called us, you know, £10 tourists, which we were, I suppose. Yeah. Well, we were supposed to be contributing to the Australian country while we were there. Sometimes we were, sometimes not.
Right, so it's an amazing story. You first went to Australia, and when you came back, you went there again by running literally across the whole of the, or almost, or a significant portion of the Eurasian continent.
Yeah.
And travelled across the Indian Ocean and ran across some of the Australasian continent as well.
That's right. The most enjoyable part was crossing Australia, I think. Because we were less terrified.
Of course, the northern part is the warmer part. Did you have a lot of trouble with?
Well, we were going along the southern. We were going from Western Australia, Fremantle, Perth, Kalgoorlie, where the goldfields were, and then across the Nullarbor. We're just inland from the ocean, really. So it was cooler. It was still hot, but the temperature wasn't a major threat. The hottest I think we experienced was in southern India. I forget now what the temperatures were, but it was hot.
Probably something over 40.
It was hot
in Celsius.
Yeah, it was. And then we got, of course, a lot of people forget that the we couldn't have a shower at the end of every run. You know, we weren't going back to home. We were just keeping in the back of a van, and water was sometimes scarce, and quite often you'd be running 30 to 40 miles in stages during the day, and then you'd be covered in sweat, obviously, but also you'd be quite achy. And the best, you know, it would have been fantastic to have a hot bath every night, but that was very rarely possible. Every now and then, someone would let us have these amazing facilities through, you know, hot water. And that was great.
So it really was sort of roughing it in some ways. You just had to go with what you had.
Yeah.
So you got a book about this.
Yeah. Throwing Plates at the Moon. It's a strange title, but it relates to living in Stoke. And as children, we used to play on the slag heaps where all the broken pottery ware was dumped. And so we'd pick up cups and saucers and sling them around. And the idea, if we were out late and it was dark and the moon was there, we would throw plates at the moon, and it was like, and it's that impossible dream, I suppose, the idea of the journey. That's where the link.
Of course, it really happened in the late 60s, or at least we think it did.
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
of course, it's a good way to do the dishes. Well, thanks very much, Calvin Bowers.
Thank you. Thanks.
Remarkable story, I have to say. This is the St. Ives Show.
Well, that was the St. Ives Show. If you like the sound of this town, then drive down the M5, followed by the A30, and then look for signs saying St. Ives. There's also the September Festival every year in September. The St. Ives Show Solitary Traveller was an Adventures in Audio production for Channel 107 and Soundtrack Radio. So next on the St. Ives Show, I've got with me... Next on the St. Ives Show, it's Paul Healy. He's a media multimedia.
The interviews were recorded and edited by Astrid Jones, and the narration was written by John Sharp.